Welcome to the Approaching the Natural podcast with Sid Garza-Hillman and sponsored by the Stanford Inn Eco Resort on the Mendocino coast of California. Sid is a certified nutritionist, health coach, and author of Approaching the Natural, a health manifesto, out now on Roundtree Press. Sid is also the programs director at the Stanford Inn's Mendocino Center for Living Well, one of the most holistic and integrated wellness centers in the country. The Approaching the Natural podcast explores all aspects of human health, including nutrition, movement, mindfulness, art, and much more.
Hello, small steppers. This is Sid Garza-Hillman and the Approaching the Natural podcast, where each week I come here and discuss my philosophy of health and happiness and my approach. My philosophy is that the closer we get by degrees to what is most natural for us as a species, the better we thrive. And I would say my approach is to do that in small steps. Each week I go pretty in depth on that, but every now and then I put an interview in here when I find somebody that is interesting to me in terms of a transition to health and happiness. And this is no exception, this interview. It's a gentleman by the name of Del Schroff. And I cut off the beginning of the interview where I'm going, how do you pronounce your name? It's spelled S-R-O-U-F-E and gives no indication of how it's supposed to be pronounced. Luckily, I caught a YouTube video and was, you know, not totally ignorant. Anyway, before I get to that, I just want to whip through some quick announcements. My first announcement is as a sincere apology for the people who came out for last week's Spreecast. There was technical difficulties that I did not know how to deal with. I saw the video working fine and the sound working fine, but nobody could hear or see me. So there I am answering a question that somebody typed in, and they saw a black screen and silence. So apologies. I'm doing another one on July 5th. And did write the Spreecast folks an email and say, hey, what gives? And they said, oh, that happens. You got to shut down and restart and blah, blah, blah. But anyway, they weren't around to help me during the day when that happened. So anyway, apologies. Thank you for people joining me. I'm going to give it another shot. That's July 5th. I did change the time. It's 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time now. So I'll tweet and Instagram and Facebook information about that. How do you reach me on those things, you ask? Oh, interesting. Okay. Twitter and Instagram, Sid Garza-Hillman. Facebook, transitioning to health, although Facebook will now be Sid Garza-Hillman any moment because I got an message saying that change had gone through. My website right now is transitioningtohealth.net. That too will be SidGarzaHillman.com. Can you see the trend here? I'm streamlining. Too many titles, too many things. So I'm going to make it all Sid Garza-Hillman, and you know where to find me. Okay? But you can put your email in on my homepage and get a free chapter of my book, Approaching the Natural, a Health Manifesto. T-shirts are on the way. They are at the T-shirt maker and in process, which is very exciting to me. I can't wait. And I will announce that. And thank you for people who have been expressing interest in that. It'll be really fun, I think. That's about it, except for that this podcast is sponsored, as always, by the Stanford Inn Eco Luxury Resort on the Mendocino coast of California. And their wellness center, which I head up, is called the Mendocino Center for Living Well, and that's at livingwellmendocino.com and stanfordinn.com, where you can find me and the retreats that we put on here and all sorts of cool stuff going on there. But I'm going to keep this intro short and sweet. I had a really nice conversation with Del. There's a woman who kind of helps put my name out there here and there. And I said, you know, if you got anybody in the that you know of that would be a good interview based on what I do here. And she made a few suggestions and I honed on him for a whole host of reasons that you'll hear during this interview. He is just a super nice, genuine, which is what I really liked, guy. He is in transition on his own health and happiness, which I found very interesting as well, because he's in the middle of it right now, and he's going through the things that we all go through. And he was kind enough to get very personal with me, which I think is hard for people to talk about. I think he's very brave. And he's doing great work in the world right now, and I think that you should listen to this interview for that reason. His actual job is that he's the co-owner and executive chef of something called the Wellness Forum Foods, which is a whole food plant-based delivery and catering service in Columbus, and that was where he was talking to me from. But he's best known for being one of the authors of Forks Over Knives, the cookbook. That was the best-selling cookbook following the movie Forks Over Knives. And he has since put out a book called Better Than Vegan, which came out last December, which is doing extremely well too. But when I talked to him, he had literally just turned in everything for a brand new cookbook that will be out soon. So he teaches cooking classes, does catering, and just a really nice guy. What's more interesting to me, and you'll hear how we get into this, is his own personal story, which again, I found very compelling, and I hope you will too. Del Shroff. So I'll leave you to that. I don't think I have any other more announcements. I will be back, as always, next week with another episode of Just Me that you'll have to sit through. If you want to email me any questions, podcast@transitioningtohealth.net. I want to thank people who have been writing me in between, leaving me Facebook messages. Good stuff, good questions. I'm feeling like we're all engaged. This is a small step revolution. And I am the small step advocate. So we're doing this together. And I think we're getting somewhere with this. So without much further ado, I will leave you here to hear this interview with me and Chef Del Shroff. I hope you enjoy it. But it came out last December?
Yeah, December 3rd.
So is it keeping you busy just getting out and about?
It is. I actually just finished writing my next cookbook. So I just turned that manuscript on Monday. So that's kind of where I've been the past 2 months, actually.
And then you have like a test kitchen that you work from and a staff of people that help you, or you're kind of on your own on these?
As far as writing the cookbook, I do them pretty much myself. We have a commercial kitchen, so a lot of things get vetted through there. But I tend to do a lot of my cooking at home on my own, just because oddly enough, I'm not really, recipes aren't my thing. I prefer just to, you know, organically let food become what it will. But people want that specificity of a recipe, you know. So it takes me a lot of concentration to get the recipe the way that it is in my head.
Yeah, we have the same because we at the Wellness Center, we do cooking classes. In fact, there's one going on literally beneath me right now. And we have the same thing. A lot of our cooking and our creative director is done by feel, you know, and then people want to come in for a class and they want to know how to measure. And we sort of say, here's the recipe. However, on a given day, it could taste different. And so you got to get in there and taste it and adjust. And that's part of the beauty of cooking as well.
Yeah, I try to teach it as much as possible, but people are always like, well, how do you want it to taste? And I'm like, oh, boy. How I want it to taste changes from day to day, too. So you're in trouble if you want to go by that.
That's right. So was cooking, I guess I do want to start at the beginning, because I've heard your story and it is so compelling. But as part of your background, what did fuel your love of cooking, and what role did food play in your youth? In terms of in the house cooking and the role of food in terms of tradition or ritual or, you know, just the experience of meals. What was that like growing up?
Well, I think there's a couple of conversations there. But, you know, as far as the role of food in our family, it's interesting. Almost everybody in my family cooks and are good cooks. And on my father's side of the family, my grandmother was known as the best cook in Brown County, Ohio. She was a farmer's wife, and she would cook for the farmhands that would come and help do various things around there. And she got a reputation for it, but her food was absolutely amazing. It just happened to be the standard American diet. But, you know, all of our family events centered around food. So, interestingly, we see each other mostly at holiday celebrations and funerals, and those are always food events. And it's always like a feast. There's always enough food at these kinds of celebrations to feed far more people than are there. So that was the social nature of food in our lives. But I started cooking when I was probably 7 or 8 years old. Believe it or not, when my parents got divorced, my dad would let me help him in the kitchen on the weekends as he was learning to cook after being a newly divorced person who didn't know how to cook and never had to. And so we discovered things like Bisquick and what's the other shake and bake,
right? Right.
Some of those kinds of things. But they taught me some of the early basics And then by the time I was 11, 12, 12 years old, I was cooking the family meals for my mom, who was a working mother. And so I the first time that she came home and I had cooked dinner, she was so joyous that I just kept doing it. So that's kind of where it all got started for me, at least being in the kitchen. And I cook because I like to eat. I don't know that I love cooking. There are things I like about it and love about it. I love the way that food is a blank canvas that can become anything that you want it to be. But I think that the desire for good food drove my passion for being in the kitchen and cooking.
And you mean, and you're talking about, I know at this point you're talking about good in terms of taste.
Yeah.
And less and less about quality, which we'll get into later.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead.
Definitely about tastes early on in my life.
Right. And so did you bounce back and forth between your mom and your dad?
No, I was a pretty lucky kid. I had we lived with my mom, but we visited my dad on the weekends. So,
gotcha. So that's when you would do the cooking.
Uh-huh.
At his house, you would he was learning how to do that just out of necessity.
Yeah.
I remember my wife growing up, her mom went back to school and was working nights, and so her dad had to learn to cook. And there's this famous story where he the first time he tried to make pasta, he had apparently never made pasta in his whole life, which is weird for me because I'd learned early on how to do those basic kinds of things. But he put the pasta in the water, in the cold water at the same time, and then turned it on. Yeah. And I just remember that story. It's just so funny, you know.
Yeah, I think we all have those cooking stories that sort of tell of the process of learning for us. You know, for me, it was the first time I made pancakes out of the Bisquick, and my uncle lived with my dad at the time, and he was so mad at me because I overmixed the pancake batter so that it would be tough and chewy.
Got it.
And,
yeah,
it's the first time I learned that there's this rule about mixing up flour and batter. So
right, and that there's a right and wrong way, you know, that people perceive with regards to how things should be.
Right,
which is interesting too. So yeah. So now let's get into because you say you learned to cook around 7 and 8, and I did read that that's around the time that you were already fairly heavy as a child, and I wanted to know what part that played in terms of what was fed to you, or were you urged to finish everything on your plate? I mean, we all grew up with these kind of standard American messages, and I wanted to know what that played for you.
I think there was a little bit of a lot of that, actually, the finish what was on your plate mentality. But, you know, at some point, I learned how to use food to push emotions back. And it wasn't until years later working with a therapist that I actually recognized that. But I see it now because I can see now that I've learned to identify certain triggers as triggers towards eating that I can actually have a conversation with myself about not going in that direction if that's not what needs to be happening. In other words, eating to deal with emotion is not a good thing. But I learned to do that. And when my parents got divorced, I think that's probably what happened. And then also food becomes this consistency. You know, life was bad with mom and dad for a period of time. It wasn't a pretty divorce, but what was always consistent was the food. Even when mom and dad weren't doing well, dinner still was good. And dinner was always on the table. And I think it became that kind of a tool for me.
Right, and I go a lot into in my, you know, my podcast when I don't have guests. I go into a lot of the addictive quality. I call them light box foods, and you and I are on the same page given what I've read about you. But I just term them light box and heavy box, and what it means is the heavier box of food means more of the micronutrients, fiber included with the calories. That's a heavier box. So if you hear me say that, just that's where I'm going. So it just slips out. You know, I can't even help it anymore. Anyway, but what I talk about a lot in the podcast is, of course, when we do eat for emotional reasons, we don't tend to go to heavy box foods in those times. We go to the light box foods because they do trip that pleasure center kind of thing, and it becomes a distraction for us. So I'm assuming that's kind of your trek now, moving to a more whole foods based cuisine. That I'm wondering if that plays out too. this is a long way of saying the heavier box foods, I find the harder people overeat them. I've put clients just as a test in front of a huge bowl of lettuce and said, you know, eat as much as you want. And they never do because it's, they're more aware in the moment. Has that been an experience for you at all?
Yeah. I know what you're saying. And I think the problem is that once you've learned and the body has learned, quote, the light box theory of eating, you know, we tend to gravitate towards those fulfilling that pleasure center. So when everything else in the world is going wrong, there's this one thing that you can count on, and that's sugar or whatever that triggers that pleasure center for you. So for me, definitely the best way to shove an emotion back down my throat was with cake and donuts and high fat foods, and not with lettuce and vegetables.
Right, which totally makes sense. Now, did your unhappiness in general, once you became heavy, did that translate into issues at school, or was your social group wasn't affected so much, or how was that?
There were times when, you know, it's interesting how when you become overweight, you're kind of invisible. And remember back in 1968, 69, there were a smaller percentage of kids who were overweight. So it was a different kind of time when you stood out more. The only time that there was some teasing, a little bit of that when I was in school. Actually, I had more of it at home with my older brother. I think I faced more teasing there and more bullying at home than I did in school. So I don't know that makes me unique in any kind of way, but it made it almost normal so that if you experience it out in the world, then it seemed like what was supposed to be happening.
And do you have a distinct memory of wishing you weren't overweight?
Oh yeah, I have many. And I think I think the first time though that I may have thought that is when someone else remarked negatively about the way that I looked. I think it's then that you wish that you were different because, you know, as kids, we want to fit in, we want to be accepted, we want to be loved. And so for someone to criticize you is and without any kind of constructive benefit, then you really struggle with that as a kid.
Right. And did you ask? I did some research on you and everything. And one of the interviews you did, you said you were put on you said it by a doctor, so I'm assuming it's a high protein, but it was only 800 calories a day. Were those kind of shake things that drive me literally through the roof. Was that because you asked for help or because somebody stepped in and said, hey, we got to deal with this?
No, I think it was because we had a pediatrician who looked at my younger brother and I and said that this is what needed to happen. But and let me correct you. We actually, there was no high protein shake back then. There was no guidelines that I can ever remember other than only 800 calories a day.
And who was doing the counting for you?
Well, supposedly my mom, but I don't ever remember that happening. I never counted calories. I was never given a chart or a list. I never saw my mom have one. But I do remember that for the most part, with few exceptions, we had pretty healthy food. Like my mom didn't have there was no candy that was bought into the house. There was no, we were eating whole wheat bread as kids. We were eating skinless chicken, which at the time everyone thought was healthy. Skim milk, which everyone thought was healthy. And we were doing portion control. And that was the diet back then. Of course, the problem with that kind of diet is, you know, the fact that hunger doesn't get satisfied, and that causes a whole other range of problems.
Right. So did you find yourself more miserable doing, and how long did that 800 calorie a day process happen? How long did that go on?
I remember three or four weigh-ins at the doctor's office. And I think it happened at the time because my brother also found out that he had allergies at the time. So he was getting tested for those. So I know for like three or four weeks, I can remember that we went in to get weighed, and then I don't remember it after that.
Do you remember how you felt physically? I mean, you must have been energetically drained. I can't imagine you felt.
Yeah, I don't remember that at all. And I think it's interesting, the memories that you have and the memories that you don't. I think there are always these key moments that you remember in your life. So I remember the scales. I remember my younger brother losing more weight than me. I remember those kinds of things. Then I remember being chastised by my older brother for being fat. He never had a weight problem. But I don't remember me being miserable. But I do remember that given a chance to sit down at the buffet that may have been at my grandmother's house with at my father's mother, or going even to my dad's house on the weekend, food was not restricted.
Okay, so even while you were on the 800 calorie, there were times when you it wasn't monitored.
Oh yeah, yeah. Okay. I think the monitoring went away pretty quickly.
It did. Now the weight that you lost, you know, assuming let's say it took 3 or 4 weeks and then it kind of dropped off a little bit, did you remain fairly heavy into? I mean, you're only 8 years old, so you're second grade. I mean, what was the rest of elementary school like for you?
Yeah, I don't ever remember the weight. You know, I don't ever remember being thin as a kid. And having said that, even at my thinnest point, which was in high school, because I was in marching band and I walked to school, which is a mile and a half every day until I got a car, I guess part of it is that, you know, when you're told that you're fat every day, and I say this to people still, I lost all the weight. I've gotten down smaller than I am now. I still have 40 plus pounds to lose. And I've been smaller than this and still felt like a fat person. And I think that's what happens when you're told that you're something or you're a certain way every day of your life, then you come to believe it. And it's really hard to change that belief system.
Right. I mean, my whole, you know, one of the things my podcast is dedicated to is those efforts in small steps, and that it's the actions. I guess the message I try to send my listeners is that the act of putting in, let's say, another heavy box food in your body is much larger than the actual food. It's the message that you're treating yourself well and all the things that are associated with that. And then has that been part of your experience as well? And what I want to get to, I guess, is the how much is it for you now as an adult? Is it about weight loss versus health? I mean, obviously, you know as well as I do that there's a 1,000 diets out there. So what was it for you that made you, at what point did you move to vegan and then a whole foods vegan thing? When did it shift more toward health and less about weight loss? Or where is that for you right now?
Well, I went vegan in 1997. I opened up a vegan bakery, and that is actually where I gained the 200 pounds that took me to almost 500 pounds. And about 1999, I started manufacturing and selling product to the Wellness Forum, and I started doing cooking demonstrations at the Wellness Forum and attending Wellness Forum events. But it wasn't until 2005 that I actually became a Wellness Forum member. So I actually, at a certain point, I had fallen in my backyard, and I turned and I broke a bone in my foot. And I didn't have health insurance at the time, and so I got up and walked into the house, and I wrapped my foot in a bandage and took 2 aspirin and went back to work, because if I didn't work, I didn't make money being self-employed. And the foot never healed. Of course, I never had it x-rayed to see if it was broken or what. I found that out later. But it didn't heal, and it kept hurting. And finally, I knew that it was most likely because of all the weight that I was carrying around. And I finally had to pay attention to, quote, the elephant in the room. And that's when I went to the Wellness Forum and started taking our classes. So the classes, and the thing I love about our classes is that it really instills to you that being healthy isn't just about weight loss. A lot of us are overweight, but, you know, there are thin people with cardiovascular disease. So it's about getting the dietary pattern right and then really approaching, and I think you've talked about this whole approach to health that includes not just diet, but exercise, and about dealing with stress differently in your life, and about being properly hydrated. And then we take it a step beyond now to being able to deal with the rest of the world, the medical profession, and all of the information that's put out there for you that's misleading and wrong and all of that. So it's become more about the total health for me, but I still deal, although more successfully, with my own eating issues. So I, every day, if I have a frustrating day or if I have an angry moment, and highly aware of the triggers that lead to maladaptive eating. And right. So I started to pay attention to those. You know, and when you're overweight, I know that I will never achieve optimal health until the weight is completely gone. I know that I'm a lot better than I was 5 years ago. You know, I'm a guy who a big guy with normal blood pressure and no diabetes and no other indications of ill health other than the weight itself. You know, it all has to be dealt with now. So it's all part of the same package to me.
Okay. And then, and just to place this in time, when did you, what year was it when you broke your foot?
2004, 2005.
So you had been vegan. And I really want to stress what you said, because I told you before we began the interview that, that for me, it goes way beyond labels, and that you can be vegan and be extremely unhealthy, which is what you said. But what was your motivation to start a vegan bakery? I mean, at that point, you're, I don't know exactly how old you are, but in 97, I'm assuming you're around 40. And what had you, what was your background? What was your education? What did you, what landed you there? For what reason?
Well, it was not certainly in the divination or the plan of life. I was attending Ohio State University, studying business and hating it, and working for a major department store selling men's clothing, and decided that I needed to get some kind of management experience, and was offered a job at a local vegetarian restaurant. And in spite of me not being vegetarian or even having an interest in it, I said yes and took the job and went to work there. And I worked there 8.5 years. And in the course of those 8.5 years, I slowly changed my diet to a vegan diet. But you have to remember, 1989, when I started there, this restaurant was vegetarian with some vegan options. In other words, it was a lot of dairy, a lot of eggs, a lot of fat. So it wasn't the diet that we think of now when we think of a whole fat, Whole Foods, low fat, plant-based diet. It was a high fat diet. And of course, for me, that meant, yeah, I can still eat and enjoy all this really good food that I recognized. And here I was. But we transitioned the restaurant to be even healthier from the time that I started there to the time I left. I began baking, and I converted a lot of our recipes to vegan just because there was a demand for it. We converted our menu to being about 50% vegan or more because there was a demand for it, and we did really, really well with it. So, you know, over those 8.5 years, I slowly transitioned my own diet to a vegan diet, and that's when I opened the bakery.
So I just, as a side note, am shocked that there was a demand for vegan back then. I mean, we have a vegan restaurant here, but in many parts of the country, and I would say especially Ohio, although I've seen this change, it's kind of amazing how many vegan restaurants are opening up. But back then, I mean, that's what kind of desire was there?
We were a very successful restaurant. We were one of two at the time, but you know, Columbus is an interesting town because it's a big college town and it's a big professional town. Mm-hmm. So I started college in 1979 and used to go eat breakfast at a vegetarian restaurant, though I didn't think anything about being vegetarian at the time. So there's been a vegetarian presence here. Maybe it was ahead of the curve of the rest of the country, but it's been around for a long time. It's just that now there's a much wider recognition of what it means to be vegetarian or vegan.
And what was the owner of that restaurant's, was it mostly market driven choice to shift things to vegan, or what was the motivation there for him or her?
Well, actually it's interesting. You know, her opening the restaurant was in part a statement of her own beliefs. She was vegetarian and believed in it and wanted the rest of the world to see that vegetarian food could be good. That's why she opened the restaurant. She had been a political activist in Columbus for years before I met her. But she actually died in a plane crash in 1991 or 92. And then the manager and I, who were very good friends at the time, basically took over the running of the restaurant. And it was just sort of I think it was in part market driven that people were asking for more vegan options. And we went in that direction and we followed the market.
Do you remember if there was anything in the mainstream, like obviously not China study because this is pre-China study, but was there something in the mainstream that triggered that? Because I don't know when Pritikin was early, because that was like in the 70s. I remember my parents tried that out. But was there anything that came out like that? Do you remember?
No. You know what? I for us back then, our major sources of influence were in cookbooks. So the first cookbook that I remember looking at the restaurant there, which called the King Avenue Coffeehouse, was called the New Farm Vegetarian Cookbook. And it was written in the early 70s, came out of a commune in Tennessee.
Oh, I know that commune.
Yeah, so they wrote... Yeah.
The Farm. It was called The Farm.
The Farm, exactly.
Yeah, that's right.
So I had that cookbook. I learned how to make tofu out of that cookbook and tempeh out of that cookbook and do other things out of that cookbook. And then another one was Tofu Cookery by Louise Hagler, who helped write, I think, the New Farm Vegetarian Cookbook. And so it was those cookbooks. And then it was also, what's the name of the restaurant in New York?
Right now?
There's a restaurant up near Cornell University. It's been a vegetarian restaurant for decades, and I can't think of the name off the top of my head.
Not Candle.
No, that's New York City itself. Oh. I'll think of it. But okay. Anyway, the Moosewood restaurant.
Okay.
Back then was a vegetarian restaurant. It's been around forever. And it's not strictly vegetarian anymore, by the way. But we had their cookbooks. And then of anyone promoting a healthier kind of diet through all this, me and the names aren't happening. There was one guy who was kind of one of the early forefathers of this whole low-fat movement, the low-fat vegan movement, who put out a cookbook called Eat More, Weigh Less.
Okay.
And he promoted a low-fat, and I'll think of his name in a minute, he promoted a low-fat vegan diet to do that.
Gotcha.
So it was all, you know, driven for us that way, and then by the people that walked in the door to our restaurant, who asked for what it is they wanted.
And then did the restaurant close, or did you decide to break off and start your bakery?
In 1997, I left to open my bakery, and then in 1999, they sold it to its current owner. It's actually still there, though it's no longer a vegan restaurant. They turned it into an upscale vegan restaurant that's actually been nominated for a James Beard Award.
Wow.
So he's an amazing chef. He's extremely talented, though now they're not vegan at all.
I gotcha. Because they probably market forces played a part there too. Anyhow, we often say if we weren't vegan at this inn, we'd probably do a lot better, but that's how that goes. So now let's cut to... you in 1997, you've got your bakery going, and I'm assuming you're making a living at it, but I know that you were eating, at that point, predominantly light box. How, was it a one man show? I mean, did you have to just work ton of hours and you just, your own health just fell by the wayside?
Yes, it wasn't a one man show. I had employees, and especially as I got, you know, I was gaining weight almost from the beginning, I threw myself into my work. I worked 80 to 100 hours a week. I stopped exercising and I stopped paying attention to my diet. I was walking into the bakery and eating hot scones and coffee in the morning and then not eating for many, many hours until the hunger kicked in again. And that was my life. And you know, the starvation is just as bad. What we don't do is just as bad as what we do in terms of eating. Underfeeding the body is a bad, bad thing too.
Agreed. I want to get a little deeper, and you can just go as deep as you are comfortable going. But do you remember thought processes during this time? I mean, how much did you immerse yourself in your work, or what was going on in your personal life that may have, no pun intended, fed those behaviors? Do you have a memory of that?
I really, and I still suffer from that to this day. I really locked myself into my work, and the there's an advantage and a disadvantage to that. I locked myself into my work, which means that I didn't have to deal with anything else, and people forgave me for that. In other words, because I was a struggling business owner, I didn't have to be held accountable for even family funerals sometimes because, you know, I didn't work, the business didn't open kind of mentality. You know, life happened. I remember at some point after I closed my bakery, when I was really, really, really heavy, a cousin of mine died, and he was younger than me. He was 28 when he died. He weighed over 400 pounds and ate not nearly close to a vegan diet. I doubt that he ate vegetables, but he fell and broke his ankle, and in surgery had a blood clot get loose and go to the brain and kill him. And I remember thinking that his stepfather at the time said to me at the funeral, he goes, you know, you don't want this to happen to you.
Wow.
It was kind of a thought that was there, but I buried that thought, you know, because I was trying to survive just the day of being a struggling business owner, not even a successful business owner, but being a struggling business owner at the time. So, you know, I had the advantage in one sense of being able to tune the rest of the world out. I think that's also a disadvantage then, because you don't become accountable to the world for your own actions.
Yeah. Did you have any kind of social life, or you literally were just like, you know what, 100 hours a week, like this is what's happening?
I didn't have much. I would disappear. I have, you know, good friends to this day who say, you know, I remember not seeing you for 6 or 8 months at a time. They would come to the bakery to see me, and that's basically how it happened. I've lost friends over being a business person who didn't understand my disappearing act. But I have loyal friends who've stuck with me through that. So, you know, it's interesting to try and think back to where my head may or may not have been through all of that, because I think that the business itself was another way for me to shut down the real world in the same way that eating was. So it's interesting that I was in a food business and then using both the business and the food itself to numb myself out to get from day to day.
Well, and that's what, kind of what I was, I mean, that was what I was honing in on, because I find it interesting that the, you know, as I advocate for bringing up all the areas of what makes life fulfilling in the modern world, a lot of that was blocked out, but then there was your work and your food were combined, you know, it was like a double attack, you know, and you were able to distract yourself with work, and then also your work was food. So it was just the perfect, in a horrible way, a really perfect shield to keep you kind of hidden back there.
Yeah, and I don't recommend it as a survival mechanism, because it eventually tried to kill me. You know, I mean, not being held accountable on a social basis. You know, there are social mechanisms at work that sort of help us all to know what is normal and acceptable and healthy even. And so I had two amazing roommates at the time, and I remember coming home to a house full of people. They were social people and being good food in the house. And at 8 o'clock at night, I was in bed trying to sleep and rest and survive to the next day. You know, so it's like I walked through all of that into my own realm so that I didn't have to be held accountable. And I didn't know that that's what I was doing, but that's really what was happening.
And then how long did that last? How many years?
You know, my bakery closed in 2001, so I lasted just under 4 years. And then I took a couple of weeks off and slept for 2 weeks, and then I opened up a personal chef service out of my house, and I did that for 5 years.
Okay, and then, okay, so let's get to that a little bit. So during the 1997-ish to 2001 of your bakery, I mean, was there ever a moment where you even the thought, I don't even care about the action so much, but did you at some point start to think, I gotta turn something around, this is not working for me, or were you just head down in it?
Oh yeah, I stayed head down and in it. Now it's interesting. I think there was a point when I was still in the bakery. My third year of business, I moved out. I had opened my bakery in a food co-op that I was an active member of, and didn't get along there with management. And I eventually moved out, moved my bakery into a public market. And I remember being in the public market was a lot more physically active, because it was a huge building, and my storage area was at the other end of the building. And I remember actually there was a restaurant next to me. The stall next to me was a Middle Eastern restaurant, and some pretty healthy food there. So you could get rice and you could get vegetable dishes and things like that. And they would feed me. The owner became a good friend. He was a regular weight guy. You know, he obviously didn't have a weight problem. But he would every day, I think, made sure that I ate a meal. And I actually started to lose weight for a period of time until I actually closed that business.
Until you close the bakery.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And then, I mean, it's interesting that probably he was feeding you around the time that you were skipping meals. Is that probably the case?
Yeah. I mean, for me and all of my life, and this is one of those issues I still deal with to this day, is not eating is associated with good health. Being hungry is associated with weight loss and good health in my psyche. In other words, it's what I've done for 40 plus years. So it's what my what I have somewhere deep within me as a belief system.
And I think that goes for actually a lot of people, at least people certainly that I work with, even in my own, myself, you know, there is that part of, I mean, I'm a runner now, and sometimes I find just in my personal trek that I'm not eating enough, which is a very different experience for me, you know, that I've got to eat more and that that affects my running better and actually affects my weight better and how I'm holding on to weight is a body stress response. And I think people don't understand that. Unless they start to think about health more predominantly over weight loss.
Yeah. Yeah. If you start to think about it in terms of, well, you know, and I think about it in terms of both health and weight loss, I am highly aware on a, an intellectual level that I have to eat to lose weight.
But it's, but go ahead.
It drives me nuts, but intellectually I'm aware of it and I put it and keep it in practice and see it working, so I'm willing to keep doing it. In other words, you know, even when I'm not eating my healthiest, I'm not gaining weight like I used to. Like, so I'll never weigh 475 pounds again, you right. know? You know, the two sides of it are always there, that intellectual side and then that deep-held belief side. And the two, I don't know if they battle each other so much, but they're both there.
Well, what I try to talk to people about, and also in the podcast too, is the messages associated. I mean, think about what message you're sending yourself when you don't eat, when you starve yourself. And if for me, it's like you attach thought to those actions of nourishing. It goes way beyond. If you think about, in other words, if you think about just food, you can, like you said, you can intellectually get that you need to eat more to lose weight. You get that intellectually. But what's hard is the messages, I think, when you attach messages to beyond just the science of it and say, I also need to actively take care of myself versus deprive myself. I mean, what kind of messages does that send to people here in the modern world? And I think we think too much about weight. And so therefore we go, well, you eat less and you lose weight. That's what happens. And so, but it's not the attachment of what we're looking for with weight loss, which is to live healthier and happier.
Yeah, too much of the conversation surrounding weight loss is about achieving those short-term goals. So we want to look better in our bathing suit. We want to look better at the beach. We want to get ready for the wedding. And it's like we teach a weight loss class, and we say it all the time. You can do anything for 21 days. You can do it, but what are you going to do for the rest of your life? And how do you develop and maintain those habits that are going to help you to be healthy for the next 40 or 50 years. I'm 53 years old. I don't want to die now. And I don't want to live in an unhealthy body that's incapable of doing all of the things that I think I want to do in life.
Right. And it's so far beyond longevity. I mean, at this point, you know what I mean? It's like, yes, you don't want to die now, but you also, even if a machine could keep you alive till 97, that's not a good picture either.
Yeah, it's about quality of life. It's not just the number of years. If I died a year from now, I'm hoping that I can live my best possible life, and that isn't spent starving or unable to get up off the couch because my knees hurt so badly, or being tired because I'm pre-diabetic and can't get the glucose figured out in my system, or even managing the medical system that keeps people alive but not healthy.
Right. And so I mean, I think we're obviously on the same page of that, but I think more of the message of, cause I always say if you just want to lose weight, that, you know, Atkins will have you lose weight, it'll kill you, but it'll make you lose weight, you know? And it's so much, I try to get to, what do you really want by losing weight? And I believe it's because people want to be happy in their lives. And so when you focus on that, you make different choices about nourishing versus depriving.
Yeah, we have a section in our weight loss that talks about the difference between pleasure and happiness.
Yes.
And we can achieve pleasure very, very easily, but it doesn't necessarily bring us happiness.
Yeah, I completely agree. I just, as a completely an aside, I referenced this in an older episode of a podcast, but I found a cookbook, a diet book on Amazon that was specifically, I almost respect it more because it didn't make any false promises. It was literally designed for a short term to get in your dress for your wedding. And then beyond that, it was like, we don't care about beyond that. Like, this will just get you into the clothes for your event. And I was like, boy, they're not even like trying to make it sound like anything different. I thought that was so funny.
Well, you know, I think the sad part of it is there's this big social equation that's going on. And then part one of the social equation is the short term, get me into my dress thing. And then part two of it is I don't have to worry about my health. That's my doctor's job, or that's the healthcare professional's job, and they have pills to fix all of that. So when we're locked into that kind of a social construct, you know, it's almost, it's a pretty rough place to be if you start thinking differently and thinking outside of that box.
You mean it's sort of like to break, I mean, I address this all the time, that the pills can keep you alive, but that, you know, you're not going to live necessarily, but you think that's it's a fear-based place to live because so much of our safety net is built into the Western medicine model.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
I mean, I have kids, you know, and because I'm a nutritionist, I make choices for, you know, we're 100% plant-based. I make choices based on what I know, but if I didn't know what I know, I would be scared to death not to feed my kids cow's milk. You know, given what I learned at the doctor's office.
Right. Oh, yeah. And unfortunately, that fear is just perpetuated in, you know, not just the doctor's office, but in the advertising on television and in the social lives that we lead. Everyone around us is saying, oh, my God, you don't let your kid drink milk. What's wrong with you?
Yeah. I mean, it's like people look at me like I've somehow, like I'm almost, really, I'm not even exaggerating. There's an abuse element that I'm somehow abusing my children by not feeding them cow's milk. I mean, it's that deeply ingrained. What's fascinating for me about you is that, I mean, it wasn't even in the weight loss realm. You were a vegan baker. It blows my mind that you were kind of even delving into that thing. If you wanted to open a bakery, it probably would have been easier for you to open up just a non-vegan bakery. You probably would have made more money.
I think the sad thing is that I'm glad now because I've written two cookbooks, working on my third, and I'm having some success with that. But I probably am the last person that should ever work in the food business.
It's
just not a good idea for someone who sees food as a trigger for pleasure.
Yeah, sort of like the alcoholic bartender.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and then there's also, of course, the people who almost, once they've sort of gotten through and in control of those kinds of messages and behaviors, almost feel empowered by being around that because it's a constant reminder of where they have become. And I wanted to know if that's becoming a reality for you in terms of your own trek. What I love about you and why I was so excited to interview you is because you're still in it. Like, you know, you're not going, yeah, that was then, and now I have no problems, because I have food issues. You know, I think we as human beings in the modern world, we are bombarded by all these all these foods that trigger our pleasure. We have to pay attention. What is that like for you now, in terms of your own practice? Where are you now in that?
Well, I think it's easier for me in part because I teach others, and I'm glad you brought it up because I've said this often to people. I'm glad to stand before you as an imperfect soul on a journey, because that journey is as important as anything that you'll learn in this life. It's not about the beginning or the end. It's where you are now. And every one of us has to stand where you are now and relate to the world. In other words, every day I have to get up and go out into a world where people want me. When I go to the Krispy Kreme donut place, which I don't do anymore, but when I went to the Krispy Kreme donut place, they were always trying to upsell me to the 3 or to the 6 or to the 1 dozen donuts, thinking that, you know, that was a good thing for them to do. And for me, it's the worst thing in the world. But that's the world I live in, that wants to supersize everything that I do and every food choice that I make. All right. So the key then becomes to start having good conversations, not only with yourselves, but those around you. So for me, a lot of the conversations, and it becomes muscle memory. So this is getting easier, not harder. There's this muscle memory about every time that I see a donut, there's a trigger that goes off. Now, it used to be, I want that donut. Now it is, well, I want that donut, but it's not taking me where I want to go. And seeing a donut and having to have that donut are not necessarily is not necessarily the equation that's best for me. It's okay to see unhealthy food and to say no to it.
Go ahead.
You know, I'm having these different conversations than I used to. It used to be I didn't have any conversation. It used to be that seeing a donut was like all of a sudden a fixation that did not go away until I had a donut or 6 or 12.
And now
I can put it aside, and 10 minutes later, I will have forgotten about the donut.
Okay, and how much of that was you becoming aware of your feelings post-donut? And what I'm getting at is that for a lot of my clients, I try to build in, you know, I'm 100% about building in behaviors. And so part of it is when people I work with eat something, I never tell them what not to eat. All I do is say, well, think about how you felt after you ate that. And yesterday when you had an apple, how did you feel after you ate that? Did that play into, was there any shame or was it just not in your consciousness about then because it was just what you did all the time?
The practice of eating a dozen donuts there was not an ounce of thought of shame or guilt in it. And in part because it goes back to the fact that what that dozen donuts did for me was to numb me out.
Right.
Literally would eat a dozen Krispy Kreme donuts and go home and lay down on the couch and go into a pre-diabetic coma, unable to move for 4 or 5 hours. So that's the kind of level of numbing that happened as a result of making that decision.
Now, so on that note, when you left the bakery in 2001, were you at your heaviest?
I don't know, because I didn't weigh myself often, and this is something I don't talk about too publicly very often. But at 475 pounds, there aren't too many places that you can go and get on the scales.
Right. Literally, the scales won't work.
Some point, in order for me to find out how much I weighed, I actually had to ask a friend of mine who was a veterinarian if I could get on their scales at their office.
Right. And was there associated, you said a pre-diabetic coma, was that literal? I mean, were you having at that point real medical issues? Were you on prescription meds and all these kinds of things?
I haven't been to a doctor in 25 years, but I know that there were times when I would eat the food that I talk about eating that I literally felt paralyzed on the couch. And I, you know, it's just an assumption that that's what it was, but it wasn't good, because if there had been an emergency, I was in this half in and out of conscious kind of state. And I hate to say it, part of me was kind of blissed out by it, because my body had shut down and I was barely conscious and you know, therefore didn't have to do anything or be accountable to anything or function.
I mean, right. I see that it's by every definition as an addictive behavior, as a drug addiction. I mean, you literally were put in a stupor.
Yeah.
I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's insane, isn't it? I mean, it's kind of an insanity.
Yeah, it is. And it's like we're up against this stuff. So it's so hard in the modern world to, you know, I don't joke, but I always say, you know, we look at people who are overweight and go, geez, I wish they'd eat less. And it's like, it's not about that. It's like, it is a drug addiction. Unless you come at it like that, you can't expect somebody to change their behavior.
Yeah. And, you know, I spend, and I've gotten really good at this now, like I really don't listen to what others have to say about my eating. And you know, most of my good friends, it's not a conversation we have unless we bring it up together.
Uh-huh.
It's another kind of trigger when someone else is trying to tell you how to eat to be healthy, and then half the time they don't know what they're talking about.
Right. Okay. So let's get, you know, completely agree. I just, it is a fascinating story, because what I want to get to is, so then you leave the bakery and you've got your personal chefing. I want to get to the point in your life. I think what I'm wondering is how much of your job inspired you to improve your health. I mean, it's kind of weird. Like, you were in the world of vegan as a chef, as a baker. Then you went to the personal chef. Was that vegan or vegetarian, or was that just a personal chef for whatever?
Yeah, that was vegan.
What? So you were. It's so fascinating to me. So it's almost like your job dictated, played a part in the. In your practice, or still does. I mean, you're doing incredible cookbooks. I mean, I've got I'm holding Better Than Vegan, which is, I don't even know if there's any oil in any of those recipes. Is there?
Yeah, it's oil free.
I mean, unbelievable. So, your job almost, what part did I just find it fascinating. You were doing these jobs that were in a way inspiring you to become healthy, or is that not what was happening?
No, that wasn't what was happening. And I'll tell you why. When I became a personal chef, here's what I did. I cooked out of my own kitchen. I would deliver meals to people who most of the time weren't home so that I never saw them and they never had to see me, dropping foods into coolers and collecting payment by PayPal, and going home and then sleeping the rest of the day to recover and to diminish the pain so that I could get up and do it again the next day. And then I also, it got to a point where I only worked 3 days a week.
By pains, what do you mean? Physical pains?
The physical pain of being 475 pounds.
So joints and just walking around and the whole thing.
Joint pain, yep. And the fatigue of it.
So what was the tipping point?
When I fell and broke the bone in my foot.
That was the tipping point.
That was the tipping point. And then, that was the beginning of the tipping point. It took some time after that, but that was, you know, there was a point when you it hurts just to move. You know, I remember the day that I walked into the wellness forum and I sat down at the table where Dr. Popper was sitting and said, "I need some help." And, you know, she looked at me as casually and calmly as anything. And she goes, I think you should take our Wellness 101 class. And it there was no judgment there and there was no sales pitch needed. It was just this transaction that said, okay, let's bring you into this place and see if we can't help you.
And what was that? If you could just describe that process.
So we teach a 10-hour course called Wellness 101, and you get a textbook and you sit down with a teacher, an instructor once a week, and there's like some food sampling. But the textbook is great. It has recipes for healthy eating. And then it goes through and talks not only about what the healthy diet looks like. We have our own food pyramid, but it also talks about, again, like I said, the need for exercise, proper hydration, and then the science behind it all. So this textbook is referenced so that you can go and look and see what scientists are saying and what good science says about what we're talking about. And for me, that really resonated. It was more than just, again, a sales pitch. They didn't even charge me for the class. I took it free.
What year was this?
2006, sorry.
And you broke your foot in 2005, right?
Yeah.
So that was a 10-hour class? I mean, how did they break that up?
Four classes of 2.5 hours each.
And okay, so then you did that. You're still doing the personal chefing?
Yep.
Okay. So then what, so by my calculation, you're sort of toward the end of your personal chefing.
Yes and no. In 2006, Dr. Popper, basically bought my business and moved me into the wellness forum and built me a kitchen. And I went to work there.
So after your, the four classes to the 10 hours, how did you continue with that group?
I was there, you know, there were a lot of regular events, and I actually, it's interesting because I actually did cooking demos for the Wellness Forum to introduce some of the products that I manufactured for them. So I'd been manufacturing products for them since 1999. And so I attended a lot of events and conferences to introduce those products.
Oh, before you even asked her for help?
Yeah.
I got it. So you were hooked on into them while you still had the bakery?
Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha. Now, when you did products for them, you know, you said in your bakery it was organic, but it was still, you know, refined flour and things like that. Did you do special things for them that educated you a little bit at that point on the move to Whole Foods?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because I think that I was aware even back to when I was at King Avenue, we had some pretty healthy dishes. Like one of the dishes that we had was you could get steamed rice and cooked beans and steamed vegetables. So you could get that as a meal. We had a juice bar so you could do those things. So it's not like I was completely unfamiliar with healthy choices. It's just that I wasn't making them all the time.
Got it. And go ahead.
When you do starvation and binge dieting, in other words, when not eating and then eating large quantities, whether we call rebound eating as a part of your life, then that makes sense. So there are times all through my life when I've been a relatively healthy person who is active physically. I used to ride a bike 150 miles a week, even right after I first started at King Avenue, when I was, you know, not nearly so big.
So it wasn't until this survival mechanism kicks in where I give up all those healthy practices to save my business that there was a turn for the worse. And at some point, you just let go. You just give yourself permission to not pay attention to your own health because you're trying to save this bigger picture.
Got it. Okay, so now I want to cut to where does Forks Over Knives come into the picture?
And I forget the year. It might have been 2009. Dr. Popper was speaking at a conference on the West Coast. Dr. Campbell, T. Colin Campbell, was there at this same conference as a speaker. And Brian Wendell, who was the originator of the Forks Over Knives brand, was there to – he had read the China study and wanted to talk to Dr. Campbell about making this movie about his life and his work and the work of Dr. Esselstyn as well. And he heard Dr. Popper speak at this conference and knew that he had to find out more about her. So he came – he did a cross-country. They filmed people across the country when they were making this documentary. So I know that they were at the Farm Sanctuary in New York to see Gene Bauer and all kinds of people along that path. So he came to come to Columbus and they spent 2 or 3 days and they actually interviewed me for an hour in my kitchen. It didn't make it into the movie, but they, I fed them while they were here and Brian really liked the food.
Nice.
And so the last scene of the movie, Dr. Popper became science editor for the movie and then for the book that came out, and kind of a science researcher slash editor. And the last scene of the movie, Brian asked me if I would come up to Dr. Esselstyn's home in northern Ohio and prepare food for this last meal. They wanted all of the main participants of the movie to have a meal together. So I did the food for that. And then the book comes out a year after the movie, and I had 7 recipes in that. And then I get this phone call one day a year after the book comes out, and Brian's on the phone, and he's talking to me about this cookbook that they want to do and asked if I'd be interested in participating. And I said, sure. And I'm assuming, you know, I'm going to give 7-10 recipes.
Right.
And he says, well, okay. He comes back to me and he says, well, we've got some other writers, but they're going to do 10. This person's going to do 10. That person's going to do 10. And then Issa Moskowitz, who's a vegan cookbook writer, is going to do the dessert section. I'm like, okay.
Yeah, we know her well.
We'd like you to do the rest. And I'm like, well, how many recipes do you want to do? To show that people can eat this way 365 days a year. So we want 300 recipes.
Oh, my God.
I said, okay. And, you know, I'm the kind of guy that says yes to opportunity when it knocks. And he says, you know, and you need to have the manuscript done in 90 days.
So there was your 100 hours a week again. Full circle.
900 hours a week. I had 90 days to write that cookbook. And I got up at 6 o'clock in the morning and worked until 11 o'clock at night, 7 days a week, including Christmas, on that cookbook.
Wow. Unbelievable. And had you, we never actually got into this, but did you have formal chef training?
No.
So you literally, what did you study at Ohio State?
I studied business.
Business, that's right. You didn't like business. So you never were formally trained, but you got the feel.
Yeah, I guess as there's one author says, I've got my 10,000 hours of training in. In other words, I've been cooking. My entire professional career has been in vegetarian and vegan cooking kitchens.
I think you might have gotten the 10,000 hours of training just in the 90 days to get the cookbook ready.
I think right.
Unbelievable. Okay, so that's that really gets us up to here. So now I want to kind of finish up by, and then I want you to talk about your Better Than Vegan book. When I do the intro, people will have already heard about it. But what I want to know now, so here you are now, you've got a best-selling cookbook out. You're doing this for a living. I'm assuming you enjoy what you do still. What place does your own health and play in your life today, given your work schedule today? And also, How much do you think about food in terms of what you eat? How much does it take up in your daily life on a personal level, not as your job?
Let me start with the last question first. One of the things that I've done to help me along And I have my days of struggle, but there I eat about 6 meals a day just to fuel my metabolism. But the first 3 or 4 meals are set in stone. In other words, I always have a smoothie in the morning. Then I always have a big bowl of oatmeal. It's like what I call my second meal. And then I eat lunch at work. We cook lunch for our staff every day, and I eat lunch at work. And it's always a healthy stir fry, oil free. So those are set. Later in the day, we always teach you've got to know what your next meal is going to be, or you're more likely to make bad decisions in getting to that healthy meal. And I sometimes get in trouble with that. But I don't weigh 475 pounds anymore, and I've still got weight to lose, but I'm much closer to the promised land than I am to the desert of where I came from. So that's the eating side of it. And I tell you what, you get to a place where you realize, like, I'm able to work a longer work day because I eat healthier. You know, when you start to feel better because your diet is what it's supposed to be, it's kind of a motivator to keep doing what you're doing. I spend a lot less time trying to sabotage myself or numb myself out. Instead, I try to fuel the healthy body just so that I can keep doing the work that I'm doing. So it's an interesting relationship. You know, I still have a very conscious relationship with food, probably more so because of my job.
Right.
I think food all day long. I think about how to better myself as a cook every day. So I have that kind of going on, but I also am highly aware that I have to pay attention to triggers and to stress and to those kinds of things. So I make myself sleep. Most of the time I get a lot of sleep. I tell you, I just turned in a cookbook manuscript 4 days ago, and there were 3 or 4 days last week where I got 2 hours of sleep because of the stress.
Wow.
So, you know, I was aware of that, though, and I was aware of what could happen as a result of that, and it allowed me to pay attention to my diet just a little bit more.
That's excellent. I mean, so you're in this place, and I heard in an interview you say something, and I wanted to, I guess, just end with this. You said in your interview that you've been exercising. I think this interview was from a few years ago, so it could be, you know, that you're not as exercising as much as you were, or maybe you're doing more. But you said something that I keyed in on, and that is that you're beginning to think of yourself as an athlete.
Oh yeah.
And I really want to finish by asking you now how you identify with yourself now as compared to before, if there's been a shift, where that shift is, the messages of again, like we touched upon earlier, of nourishing, of taking care of yourself, of being a feeling like you're worthy of taking care of, but also thinking of yourself as an athlete or thinking of yourself as a healthy person who's doing positive work. What are those messages? How do those messages play for you in the modern world today?
Well, the exciting thing is I work out more than I ever have. I actually have a trainer 4 days a week. I've taken up boxing.
Nice.
And I have never really identified with a particular sports or a particular activity except biking as something that I liked doing. But I remember the day, and Dr. Popper was there in the gym when I said it, that I said, oh, my God, I love boxing. And Chris looked up and looked at me, and Dr. Popper looked at me because she was my trainer for the first 4 years and remembers the days when I hated going to the gym, when I hated going into the yoga studio, when I was just a grumpy person to be around at those times because it was so uncomfortable. And I remember the day too, and this was happening in the past couple of years, when I walked out of the gym and had more energy than when I walked in, which was never the case before.
Right.
And so, you know, it changes your relationship with the activity. I found something I like doing, and I like working harder at it because I can now, instead of trying to survive a workout, I'm trying to see where the workout can take me. So how much stronger and faster can I be at what I'm doing? In other words, the goals are completely different.
Right.
You know, I'm not just trying to survive anymore, but I'm trying to thrive and to be successful at something. And that's a much different thought process. Right?
Yes.
Much different.
And it's taken you years. What I want to stress to everybody listening, because I constantly come back to, you know, my whole podcast is dedicated to be an anti-quick fix, an anti-diet. And then this is a long-term practice, but that the trek is is it. I mean, it is the journey, and it is how you approach your life day to day. And just the change of thinking around your exercise makes all the difference, and it's less about the exercise itself.
It is. And I think the one of the key things for a lot of people to do is to start setting goals for themselves. So at one time, I may not be able to do it because of my foot is still a problem. At one time, I thought about being a triathlete and about, you know, becoming a long-distance runner and those kinds of things. Putting that kind of thought into your head about the possibilities changes your behaviors right there. You know, and so having those kinds of goals and about being someone I watched, I'll never forget, I cried the day that I watched the Ironman competition for the first time and saw this 80-year-old person crossing the finish line. And this is a person who started exercising when they were in their 60s.
Wow.
And I said, oh my God, who am I to sit on this couch and moan and groan about my discomfort?
Right. Ah, man. Okay. And so here you are. So what's next? Talked about what's next. And I also just, I've said I want to finish three times now, but how do people follow you? How do people get in touch with you and tell me anything that you want my listeners to know?
I'm just now discovering the world of social media, so you can find me on Facebook. I have a Wellness Forum Foods Facebook page. I have a Del Shroff, it might be a Delmas G, which is my full name, Facebook page, Wellness Forum Foods website. The cookbook that I just finished writing is for the next China Study cookbook, so that'll be out next May.
Okay.
And you can get a hold of me through the social media pretty easily. And see what's going on. If you're in the Columbus area, I teach cooking classes on a regular basis. I teach our weight loss class across the country, and I have fun, a lot of fun doing it.
Good. Well, I hope that you and I cross paths on a personal level at some point, and you're always welcome to visit us here at the Stanford Inn, because we'd love to have you, and maybe we can set up something to have you come here and be a guest chef and do some classes or something. I think it would be super fun.
I look forward to it.
All right, awesome. Well, I really appreciate your time, Del, and good luck with everything. You deserve it.
Thank you so much, and you too.
All right, thanks a lot.
Take care.
Bye.
All right, everybody. Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview with Del Shroff. Again, I really appreciated his time, as I said at the end of there, but he's a really good guy, and I hope to, I think I'm going to try to get him out to the Stanford Inn to do some cooking classes and I don't know, something. He's a real deal. So anyway, in the meantime, keep following me here and there. Throw me an iTunes review. I saw a few more come in. I really appreciate that, you guys. It really helps get the word out. You can review the book on Amazon. That helps too. But in the meantime, take small steps, pay attention to who you want to be and how you want to live in this world, and start taking minimal, teeny steps, as small as you can handle, toward that end, and keep coming back each week to listen to this podcast. And until next week, be well.
Your cradle here, but still waking up to you. Takes me here. We probably shared a thousand dreams. Still we're wearing one. But still gazing on you, it keeps me. Thank you. no mistake. Make no mistake. This is our July. This is our July. This is our July.
This is our July.